Whatever language you translate it into, the word adultery is a shameful word. Even in our permissive 20th century, it still retains some of its social stigma. But in ancient Israel, the reproach that attached to it was enormous by comparison. For that was a society built on clan and tribe. And in such societies, everyone perceives the clear link that exists between the stability of marriage and the stability of society as a whole. Everybody knows that adultery can't be confined to just one family, as we perhaps tend to think it can these days. The whole social order is threatened by it. That, no doubt, is one of the reasons why Israel felt it not strange when Moses placed adultery on the list of capital crimes, along with murder. It was an immensely serious matter in the mind of a Jew, a shocking and disgusting thing, a disgraceful and reprehensible thing. All of which makes it quite remarkable that it's adultery, which is the crime Ezekiel charges the people of Jerusalem in this chapter 16. Look at verse 32. You adulterous wife, you prefer strangers to your own husband. No more emotive words could be chosen. The prophet's language is intended to shock and embarrass. Israel's idolatry wasn't something God viewed with the detached objectivity of a disinterested spectator. It was something he felt passionately about. Because, you see, God did not see himself as some distant uncle to his people. He saw himself as their husband. And the covenant that bound him to them was no loose and ineffectual treaty. It was a marriage vow. So when Israel forsook the Lord, it was no ordinary sin, if there be such a thing. It was spiritual adultery. And that analogy with adultery is developed at length by Ezekiel throughout this chapter. Indeed, the NIV appropriately calls it an allegory. It's one of three such extended metaphors which he inserts at this point in his prophecy, all of which have the theme of God's disappointment with Israel, with Jerusalem in particular. The allegory of the vine in chapter 15, the allegory of the two eagles in chapter 17. But this central one, the allegory of the unfaithful wife, is by far the most emotive, and we're going to just restrict our attention to it tonight. I think it will help us to get a grip on this long chapter if we break it up into four sections. First, the patient lover, verses 1 to 14. And then the jilted lover, in verses 15 to 34. And then the jealous lover, in verses 35 to 53. And then finally, in verses 54 to 63, the constant lover. Look at the patient lover first. The last half of verse 8. I gave you my solemn oath and entered into a covenant with you, declares the sovereign Lord. You became mine. There's an immense tenderness and pathos in this early part of the chapter. God is, so to speak, looking back on the experience of young love. He's scanning the centuries to recall how he'd come across Israel, an illegitimate child of pagan parents, he says in verse 3. The Amorites and the Hittites were your father and mother. A deprived child, born into ignorance and filth, he says in verse 4. Your cord wasn't cut, you weren't washed, you weren't clean. You weren't disinfected. An unwanted child, destined to die of exposure in verse 5. Thrown out into the open field. A despised female infant. God recalls how he took this unlovable wretch, even as she lay in the pool of her own placental remains, and adopted her as his own. Verse 6, I passed by and saw you kicking about in your blood. As you lay there in your blood, I said to you, live. So like a fairy story, Israel's rags turn to riches. She grows through childhood to adolescence in verse 7. You grew up, your breasts were formed. He whose pity he was once moved to adopt her as his daughter now embraces her afresh as his bride. I saw you were old enough for love, and I spread the corner of my garment over you. Hebrew idiom that, for marriage. And so the covenant was sealed, the marriage was made, the wedding took place. I entered into a covenant with you, and you became mine. And from that point onward, says Ezekiel, the Lord's extravagant generosity towards Israel overflowed inexhaustibly. He cleans her up, he clothes her, he adorns her, she becomes more and more beautiful. Verse 14, your fame spread among the nations on account of your beauty, because of the splendor I had given you. So God describes the prosperity that Israel enjoyed. Presumably he's thinking of those early days after the sealing of the covenant at Sinai, up to the glorious monarchies of David and Solomon. From first to last, it had been the story of God's loving initiative, bringing her from her squalid origins up to nobility and honor. It's a marvelous picture, this, of the graciousness of God's election, choosing his people when there was nothing in them to merit his choice at all. God is, so to speak, looking back in this chapter on those days with the nostalgia of a middle-aged family man who's accidentally come across the wedding photos one day. What a precious thing memories are to a successful marriage. And what a tragic and heartbreaking thing memories are, those very same memories, when that marriage sails onto the rocks. And that, regrettably, is what had happened to Israel. This patient, electing love had given way to a wounded heart, a jilted lover. Look at verse 15. You trusted in your beauty and used your fame to become a prostitute. Christian theologians have sometimes in the past spoken about the impassibility of God, by which they mean God cannot suffer. I wonder if they're right in that. The God of the Greek Stoics, he couldn't suffer, that's true. He was an emotionally petrified deity. He felt nothing analogous to the surging passions of us human beings. Isolated in the little island of his self-sufficiency, he needed no one. And those who believed in such a God sought to copy his detached emotional indifference. But is that the God of the Bible? Not as Ezekiel portrays him here. It's a terribly bold analogy, this, isn't it? What is the cross of Calvary if it isn't a terrifying confirmation of that agony God suffers because of his people's sin? What is Ezekiel portraying to us here if it isn't the plaintive crying of suffering born out of unrequited love? Here is a God who feels for his people, and when they sin against him, he feels hurt. Verse 16, you took some of your garments to make gaudy high places, the garments I had given you. Such things shouldn't happen. It shouldn't occur. You shouldn't have done it, he said. He's referring, of course, to the idolatry that we've spoken of on many previous weeks, with which Israel became embroiled in the later period of the monarchy. The wealth with which he had enriched her as a nation was used to build shrines for foreign deities, he said. The food with which this fertile land of milk and honey flowed was offered as sacrifices on pagan altars. Nor was that even the worst. Look at verse 20. You took your sons and daughters, whom you bore to me, and sacrificed them as food to the idols. Wasn't your prostitution enough that you slaughtered my children? A child sacrifice was a well-established part of the worship of Moloch, an Ammonite deity. And though Moses explicitly prohibited it, there are numerous references to the practice in Israel during the period of the Israelite monarchy. Ironically, as Ezekiel suggests, it was the days of her greatest economic prosperity in which this cult became established in Jerusalem. It was Solomon who was the first king to build a sanctuary for Moloch, no doubt to satisfy the whim of his Ammonite wives. Notice how God describes what they've done. You've slaughtered my children. My children. In the current debate about abortion, We hear a lot about the rights of the mother and a little bit about the rights of the unborn child. It never occurs to anybody to wonder what the rights of God are towards infant progenies. It's the ingratitude of it all that seems to sting the heart of God even more than the inhumanity of it. Look at verse 22. In all your detestable practices and your prostitution, you did not remember the days of your youth, when you were naked, bare, kicking about in your blood. So the sorry tale of spiritual degeneracy winds on. Her infatuation with foreign gods becomes an obsession. Verse 24, she sets up these crude pagan symbols in public places all across the city. The squares and the street corners are littered with them. Her wantonness becomes more and more brazen. It says in verse 25, you offered your body with increasing promiscuity to anyone who passed by. A rather nice way of putting it in our translation. What Ezekiel in the Hebrew says rather more crudely is, you open your legs to anyone. She embraces even the gods of those cruel nations that ought to have been her sworn enemies. Egypt in verse 26. Assyria in verse 28. Babylon in verse 29. Even pagans like the Philistines, says Ezekiel, were outraged by the enthusiasm with which Israel jeopardized her unique cultural distinctiveness. They were shocked by your lewd conduct, he says in verse 27. Initially, no doubt, these flirtations were politically motivated. You know, the presence of a foreign temple in the capital city in these days often indicated a military alliance between Israel and the nation in question, much as American bases in East Anglia indicate a commitment to NATO. Israel may well have had to form alliances with her powerful neighbours in the period of the later monarchy. But Ezekiel says, your appetite for idolatry went far beyond the requirements of political expediency. You no longer asked what you would gain from these pagan sugar daddies. You were prepared to pay them for the privilege of illicit affairs. Like an animal on heat. She sought new gods, a spiritual nymphomaniac who knew no shame. Look at verse 31. And like a prostitute, you scorned payment. Verse 33. You gave gifts to all your lovers, bribing them to come to you. The imagery is shocking, and it's intentionally shocking. It's meant to make us squirm with embarrassment, because only thus can the prophet communicate to us how deeply outraged the heart of God is by the apostasy of his people. It's spiritual adultery. His chosen bride has made a cuckold of him. And he's not going to, a sentimental weakling, to take that sort of unfaithfulness passively, lying down, says Ezekiel. His tears mingle with his rage. And that brings us to the third section of the chapter. The jealous lover. In verse 35, therefore, you prostitute, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Because you poured out your wealth and exposed your nakedness in your promiscuity with your lovers, I'm going to gather all your lovers with whom you found pleasure, those you loved as well as those you hated, and I will gather them against you all around and will strip you in front of them. It's a grave mistake, you see, to underestimate the significance of that second commandment. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. We think of jealousy as a vice. That's because we confuse it with covetousness. It's one thing to desire something that belongs to somebody else. That's envy. That's covetousness. That's sin. It's quite another thing to guard with possessive zeal that which is rightly and exclusively my own. Someone steals my wallet, I'm rightly angry. For I'm jealous of my wallet. It's mine. If someone steals my wife, I'm justly angry, for I'm jealous of my wife. She's mine too. The Bible, you see, believes in that old-fashioned idea of private property. A man, a husband, has property in his wife, and a wife in her husband. a glorification of communal ownership in our day, is in a very subtle way threatening the fundamental moral truth which underlies not just the ownership of land, but the family. You could say the flaw in Marxist ethics is that it can't distinguish covetousness from jealousy. And because of that, it will never really understand the nature and power of marital affection. God suffers no such blind spot. He is a jealous husband, and he will prosecute for any breach of his property rights. Look at verse 38. I will sentence you to the punishment of women who commit adultery and who shed blood. I will bring upon you the blood vengeance of my wrath and jealous anger. And ironically enough, it's the agents. The agents of God's judgment are the very nations with whose gods Israel had sported. Public humiliation and execution. These are the penalties God demands, and he says he's not going to be satisfied. His anger will not abate until they are exacted. Verse 42, then my wrath against you will subside, and my jealous anger will turn away from you. I will be calm and no longer angry. And so, his anger exhausted, there comes a point when judgment gives way to mercy. The jealous lover proves nevertheless to be a constant lover. Verse 59 and 60. I will deal with you as you deserve, because you've despised my oath and broken my covenant. Yet I will remember the covenant I made in the days of your youth, and I will establish an everlasting covenant with you. In this last half of the chapter, from verse 44 onwards, you'll notice that Ezekiel introduces a new line of allegory, though it's closely related to the previous one. Up to verse 43, Israel is pictured as a foundling child who has turned to prostitution in spite of the lavish care of her adopted parents and a loving husband. But at verse 45, her true mother reappears, the in-laws re-enter, and Israel becomes a member of a family brothel, mother and daughters and granddaughters all engaged in lecherous conspiracy. And Ezekiel is not afraid to name the other ladies in the house. Verse 45, you're a true daughter of your mother who despised the husband and her children, and you're a true sister of your sisters who despised their husbands and their children. Your mother was a Hittite, your father an Amorite, your older sister was Samaria, who lived to the north, and your younger sister, who lived to the south, was Sodom. It's not hard to imagine how infuriating it would be to Jewish nationalists to be reminded of their ethnic link with these other Semitic peoples in the Middle East, whom they'd always regarded as their inferiors. As for suggesting some kinship to Sodom, that must have been a rank insult. But Ezekiel is adamant. Among all these brazen huzzies, he says, Israel is by far the most debauched. Verse 47, you not only walked in their ways and copied their practices, you became more depraved than they. As I live, says the Sovereign Lord, your sister Sodom and her daughters never did what you and your daughters have done. Initially, then, it sounds in this second half of the chapter as though Ezekiel, by invoking this supplementary allegory, is just trying to underline the grossness of Israel's spiritual failure, which he's already portrayed by that first analogy as the foundling child in the first half of the chapter. But as this latter half of the chapter goes on, you begin to realize there's more to it than that. Look at verse 51. You have done more detestable things than they, and have made your sisters seem righteous by all these things you have done. Bear your disgrace, for you have furnished some justification for your sisters, because your sins were more vile than theirs. They appear more righteous than you. Verse 53. I'm going to restore the fortunes of Sodom and her daughters, and of Samaria and her daughters, and your fortunes along with them, so that you may bear your disgrace and be ashamed of all you've done in giving them comfort. Now, this is a very remarkable passage, very odd passage. God's saying here that one of the ways he intends to shame Israel for her bad behavior is by restoring her in company with these Gentile nations in the family brothel, which she once despised. This would be humiliating for Israel, he says, because he says in verse 56, you would not even mention your sister Sodom in the day of your pride. You disowned her. You used to think yourself superior. You'd be grossly offended to have your name linked with Sodom in the old days, he says. But, says Ezekiel, the day is coming when that chauvinistic pride is going to be broken. And you will have to acknowledge that you belong to the same family of sin as Sodom and Samaria. For the day is coming when I'm going to treat you all identically and there'll be no more favoritism. See what he says in verse 55? Your sister Sodom with her daughters and Samaria with her daughters will return to what they were before, and you and your daughters will return to what you were before. Verse 59. I will deal with you as you deserve, yet I will remember the covenant I made with you in the days of your youth, and I will establish an everlasting covenant. You will remember your ways and be ashamed when you receive your sisters, both those who are older than you and those who are younger. I will give them to you as daughters, but not on the basis of my covenant with you. I will establish my covenant with you, and you will know I am the Lord when I make atonement for you and all you've done. You will remember and be ashamed, and never again open your mouth because of your humiliation. Though Israel may prove false to her marriage vow, God's saying here that he can't abandon his promise so lightly. He could justly divorce Israel, but he feels bound by his vow to remain faithful to her in spite of all her sin. Since Israel can't commend herself to God on the ground of her own righteousness, his dealings with her will have to be once again on the grounds of grace. He must make atonement for her sins, he says in verse 63. And yet if God is going to offer forgiveness to Israel, whom he could justly reject, how can he not also offer it to those others in the fallen race of man who have sinned less heinously than Israel has, in spite of the fact that they had no covenantal obligations to keep? So you see, Ezekiel is led in this last part of the chapter to a very outstanding and astonishing conclusion. God will reconfirm that marriage relationship, he says, that covenant. He's not going to abandon it, he's not going to give it up, he's a constant lover. But no longer will that marriage be an exclusive arrangement with Israel only. No, he says, the Jews will have to accept their Gentile neighbors as co-beneficiaries within a new and an everlasting covenant, in which no more distinctions on the basis of race are made. And this would be part of their penalty. This national humiliation would be part of the penalty which they would have to pay for their failure to keep the first covenant. Now that must surely rank as one of the most interesting insights, prophetic anticipations of the gospel in the whole of the Old Testament. A lot of people find Paul's chapter in Romans 11 a very difficult passage. It's one of the most notorious passages for interpretation in Paul's letters. And yet, you know, I think read against the background of Ezekiel 16, it begins to make sense. Let me read to you some of the things that Paul says in that chapter. I ask then, he says, did God reject his people? By no means. I am an Israelite myself. Did they stumble so as to fall beyond recovery? Not at all. Rather, he says, because of Israel's transgression, salvation has come to the Gentiles to make Israel envious. Haven't you been puzzled by that? To make Israel envious. What on earth does Paul mean by that? Well, he means, I think, what Ezekiel's saying here. That it's part of the judgment of Israel for her failure to keep the first covenant, that she must now accept that she is no better than the Gentile nations. Her position is identical to theirs. Paul goes on, God's gifts and his call are irrevocable. Just as you Gentiles were at one time disobedient to God, and you have now received mercy as a result of Israel's disobedience, so too they have become disobedient in order that they too may receive mercy as a result of God's mercy to you. For God, says Paul, has bound all men over to disobedience, so that he may have mercy on them. In the strange providence of God, Israel's sin turns out to mean that her pagan relations are able to be received into the covenant, receive forgiveness. She is going to be blessed ultimately as a result of their inclusion. Israel's transgression means riches for the Gentiles. So this, you see, this chapter, though it's a difficult one, though it's a complex one, is enormously rich allegory of spiritual and theological truth. God, the patient lover, providing us with this picture of election, unconditional election, God choosing his people, even though there's nothing lovely in them at all. This picture of the jilted lover, providing us an insight into the cross, a God who is passionate about sin, who feels it. This picture of the angry lover, showing us how anger and wrath, love and wrath rather, can really coexist in the same personality, though people often talk about it as contradictory. Yet an angry lover is just that. And finally, this remarkable picture of a constant lover with reconciling grace, drawing in not just his prostitute wife, but all his in-laws too, into a new covenant of blessing. Picturing to us the way that we, who are not Jews, have a share in what Ezekiel is saying. How are we to apply this to our hearts then and to our situation today, this complex and detailed picture that Ezekiel gives us? Let me just give you three suggestions that you might like to meditate on as you read this chapter again and try and think your way into its implications. The first thing I think we learn, which we can apply to our own hearts from what Ezekiel says here, is how serious a matter it is for God's people to sin. Christianity is not just a matter, you see, of how we feel toward God. It's a matter of how he feels toward us. We are precious to him. As a wife is precious to her husband, he's emotionally committed to us. He loved the church and gave himself up for her. And so when we fail to honour him, when we put other things at the centre of our affections rather than give him first place in our hearts, he doesn't feel just a mild irritation. He experiences all the passion of a wounded husband, a victim of adultery. God isn't a heavenly policeman. The moral law is the law of his own character, and when we break his commandments, we hurt him. God isn't an academic theologian. The doctrines of the Bible are the truths of his divine nature. And when we contradict them, when we worship idols, we hurt him. Sin is not something that God can discuss neutrally and objectively, like a surgeon clinically commenting on the presence of a cancer. It offends him personally. Now let me relate that very directly to one specific area. The area of what you might call theological sin. You know, there are those, theologians among you will probably be aware of it, who want to abandon biblical studies today and replace it with a thing called religious studies. They want to set Christianity in the context of comparative religion and contemporary philosophy and make it an example of man's religious experience rather than something distinctive and unique. That's a very common trend in our schools, in our theological colleges. Many theologians are gratuitously stirring in spoonfuls of Buddhism or Marxism into their teaching. Or perhaps in the sophisticated atmosphere of the university lecture hall, that sort of eclectic policy sounds commendable with tolerance and its open-mindedness, its ecumenicity. Don't you see it was just such a syncretistic attitude which Israel was demonstrating towards the religions and philosophies of her contemporary world? And Ezekiel did not call that enlightened scholarship, he called it spiritual prostitution. Be sure of this, that's exactly how God sees these flirtations with non-biblical ideas in our contemporary theological scene. He doesn't call it just theological liberal, he calls it theologically licentious. It's unfaithful. There are sins of the intellect as well as of the body, and we have to beware of them. Some scholars seem to feel that because they are scholars, because they're involved in creative research, they must be allowed some elbow room for speculation and experiment. Well, I think Ezekiel has a word to answer their theological incontinence. Verse 30, "How weak-willed you are," declares the Sovereign Lord. Sin in the life of God's people is serious, and none more serious than theological sin. God says to the church, which abandons her commitment to the exclusiveness of biblical revelation, just what he says to Israel when she abandoned her exclusive devotion to him: "I will sentence you to the punishment of women who commit adultery." For in his book, that's what it is. The seriousness of sin in the life of God's people, and theological sin at that. The second thing, I think, by way of application to our own hearts that we might make from this chapter is this. We can learn the spiritual ruin which backsliding brings to a Christian's relationship with his God. Look at verse 43. "Because you did not remember the days of your youth, but enraged me with all these things, I will surely bring down on your head what you have done." Do you remember the days of your Christian youth? When you were first converted, how enthusiastic you were, how devoted, how much time you spent in prayer and Bible study, how concerned to know God's will. Remember those days? The days of your spiritual youth, when God graciously called you to himself and you first experienced what a wonderful thing it was to be loved by him. How does God remember those days now? Does he remember them with the sweetness and joy of a husband whose marriage has deepened over the years? Or does he remember it with the bitterness and disappointment of a man whose wife has been unfaithful to him? If it's the latter, then of one thing I'm absolutely sure: you are a very miserable person. As miserable as apostate Israel became. For no one is more miserable than a backsliding Christian. A backsliding Christian inherits the anger of an enraged heavenly husband. They know about that. At least the sinners of the world enjoy themselves for a while. For the person who truly belongs to Christ and yet forsakes him is a fish out of water. God will not allow such a one to enjoy his sin. The Spirit he's placed within us grieves over us. Guilt burdens our consciences. A blush rises to our face whenever someone says, "Let's pray." A spiritual dissatisfaction gnaws at our hearts. It's a terrible thing to have tasted the joy of relationship with God and then to lose it. No one is sadder or lonelier than a spiritual divorcee. And yet, if you are such a one tonight, I want you to take comfort from the absolutely unshakable faithfulness of God to his promises. "I will remember the covenant I made with you in the days of your youth." Not only is God will chasten us for our sin, but if we are bought with the blood of Christ, if we once closed with Christ and really engaged with him and became his, he will never damn us for our sin. Never. He will humiliate us. He will demolish our pride. He will number us as he did Israel. He will number us with the moral scum of the world. Make us know that's what we are. But it will be a scum that he intends to save. Maybe we have walked the streets of spiritual prostitution, careless of the suffering our sin causes our heavenly lover. Maybe we've added sin upon sin to the weight of agony that God bore for us on that cross. Maybe as a result we are experiencing the awful emptiness of soul which afflicts those who, like Jerusalem, forsook the fount of living waters and tried to carve out cisterns for themselves. But be encouraged. but God will take you back. His reconciling grace is inexhaustible. His anger with you will not last forever. I had to counsel a couple who'd passed through a period of estrangement in their marriage as a result of unfaithfulness of one of the partners. But marvellously, God brought them back together again. I remember what the wife said to me on one occasion when the worst was over. She said, "You know, when our marriage was breaking up, it was sheer hell. But making it up again has been like a second honeymoon." Perhaps some of us, like Israel of old, are in need of a second honeymoon with God. If that is so, His arms are open. Let's pray together.